Our text today is Psalm 33, verse 12. Blessed is the nation whose God is the Lord, and the people whom he hath chosen for his own inheritance. Blessed is the nation whose God is the Lord, and the people he has chosen for his own inheritance. And this is the word of the Lord. As we look to this text, obviously, we know the nation is going to be blessed, whose God is the Lord, but as for the people whom he has chosen for his inheritance, what people are they? Israel? Israel alone? America? America alone? Or could it be any nation that turns to God in time of trouble? We value our religious liberty here in America. But if I were to ask you this question, what is the greatest threat to religious liberty today? What would you answer? What is the greatest threat to religious liberty? China? Iran? Secularism here in America?
Liberalism and secularism.
Liberalism and secularism? Okay, I think that's a good answer. But let me give you an answer from Amanda Tyler. Amanda Tyler says, the biggest threat to religious liberty in the United States today is Christian nationalism. Well, so who is Amanda Tyler? Maybe somebody with the Freedom From Religion Foundation or American Civil Liberties Union or American Atheists or some group like this. Who is Amanda Tyler? She is part of the Baptist Joint Committee. Now, I have to quickly add to that that conservative Baptists have been very critical of the Baptist Joint Committee for many years. And I think there's good reason to think this committee definitely does not speak for the vast, vast majority of Baptists. But nevertheless, coming from a person in that position, that's quite a startling statement. The biggest threat to religious freedom in the United States today is Christian nationalism. So you might be asking first, well, what do we mean by Christian nationalism? Well, Amanda Tyler has her answer to that. Christian nationalism, in her words, is the anti-democratic notion that America is a nation for Christians alone. She goes on to say that Christian nationalists would either repeal the First Amendment or they would greatly water it down. They make America a nation in which Christianity is the official religion and in which all other religions are either unwelcome or their adherents are, at best, second-class citizens. That sounds like a rather scary movement, doesn't it? I'd say it is scary except for this. As many of you know, I've been a conservative Christian activist all of my adult life, well, actually from my teen years, so this is well over 60 years. During this time, I have interacted with thousands upon thousands upon thousands of conservative Christian activists. I have never found one who believes Christianity should be the official religion of the United States, or that non-Christians are not welcome in this country. Who and where are these people? Well, maybe Amanda Tyler met one time. I'd rather doubt it. A couple weeks ago, as part of this self-imposed neurotic schedule that I've been on, I was speaking for Luther Classical College out in Casper, Wyoming. And the president of Luther Classical, Dr. Harold Ristall, had written a very, very fine editorial in the Federalist. He said, Christianity is the real target of all the hysteria over Christian nationalism. Those who boldly lift their voices on behalf of the church and her Lord in the public sphere are facing intensive persecution for doing so. Then he goes on to say, prior to lockdowns, most of us had never heard of Christian nationalism. Rather, it appears that this powerful gaslighting term was created by neo-Marxists and is another attempt to terrify Christians out of sharing God's perspective on moral issues in the public sphere. It attempts to dissuade Christians from fulfilling their vocational duties in the civil sphere. How many of you have heard that term, Christian nationalist? A few of you have. My suggestion to you, if the term comes up in conversation, you hear somebody talk about it, best way to respond is with a simple question, what do you mean by that? What does that term mean? You will probably find that either they have no idea what it means, or they'll give a definition, something like Ms. Tyler has given, and then you have an opportunity to correct. Is America a Christian nation? Really, that all depends on how you define the term. In the sense that we were founded only by Christians and only for Christians, I would say no. Pardon me. I sound worse than I feel, but we have several here, including all three of the Huffmans and me, who are very much involved with the Plymouth Rock Foundation. And as we know, when the Pilgrims came over here on the Mayflower, they weren't Pilgrims alone. There on the Mayflower, there were some who were called Pilgrims, others who were called strangers. They didn't necessarily share the Pilgrims' vision or the Pilgrims' theology. They came for making a living or other reasons. In fact, 34 years after the Pilgrims landed, in 1654, the first Jewish congregation was established in North America, Sheriff Israel in New Amsterdam, which is now New York. We looked to the delegates who went to the Constitutional Convention, and yes, the overwhelming majority of them were Christians. But they were Christians of many different denominations. 28 were Anglican, or Church of England. 8 were Presbyterian. 7 were Congregationalists. 2 were Reformed, 2 were Lutherans, 2 were Methodists, 2 Roman Catholics, 1, his religious beliefs are uncertain, McClurg of Virginia. He was buried in an Episcopal churchyard, which indicates probable church membership, but we don't know that for sure. And that leaves about 3 who you might call unorthodox, or about 6%. So in that sense, no. We were not founded as a Christian nation. But is that what the term Christian nation means? Let me suggest another possible meaning of the term Christian nation. A nation that was settled mostly by Christians. A nation with a culture that is based upon Christian values. A nation with laws and institutions that are based upon biblical principles. A nation in which Christianity and Christians exert a major influence still even today. Now, in that sense, yes, I think America can be called a Christian nation in that sense. Is that bad? Personally, I think it's good. One thing we need to recall, though, is that God has established 2 kingdoms for the governance of man, the church and the state. And sometimes when I'm dealing with conservative Christians and circles that, the political circles and so on, sometimes I need to remind them that no, there are 2 kingdoms. And we can make a mistake if we expect the church to do what God has given to the state, or expect the state to do what God has given to the church. As Luther put it, these 2 kingdoms must be sharply distinguished and both be permitted to remain. The one to produce piety, the other to bring about external peace and prevent evil deeds. Neither is sufficient in the world without the other. And in fact, church and state, if they are properly understood, their roles are compatible. If the state is doing its job properly, defending the shores and keeping the streets safe, that will make it easier for the church to preach the word. If the church is preaching the word, they will produce good Bible-believing citizens people with integrity, and that will make it easier for the state to govern. Church and state have distinct roles, but they are compatible roles. Throughout history, we have seen these two roles, church and state. They were probably mixed for one of the first times in history when King Henry VIII in England in the 1500s separated England from the Roman Catholic Church and made it the Church of England with himself as the head. There was an official state church. That's what the Pilgrims and many others were coming to America to get away from. I assure you, they were not coming to America to get away from prayer at football games. So if we use the term Christian nation in that broad sense of the word, yes, I think we can say America is a Christian nation. But in that sense, I don't think that's a dangerous term at all. But now let's look to another term here, and that is American exceptionalism. If you look to the bulletin, there's the title there, Christian nationalism, American exceptionalism. What's this all about? We hear this term, American exceptionalism, very often. Is America an exceptional nation in the plan of God? Did God establish this nation? I think I can safely say, yes, he did, as God has established all nations. God has set up national entities to rule over us. Romans 13 makes that clear. Daniel 2 also makes that clear in other passages. God has established the nation state, and that certainly includes America. And he instituted civil government to restrain the exercise of sin. And that's true of all governments. God has used every nation in a very special way. Every nation should be looking at how God may have used their nation uniquely in his plan to bring about the kingdom of God. Judea, for example. God used Israel and Judea later to give us the word of God and to bring us the living word, the Messiah, through the seed of the woman. And after the church began, I know you had a session about that this morning, the expansion of the church, but after the church began, we see after that that he, lost my place here for just a moment here. What was I going to say? After the church began, he used Jerusalem as the center of Christianity until 70 AD, when Jerusalem was destroyed by the Romans. At that time, a lot of people don't realize this today, but the center of Christianity became North Africa. Think about this for a moment. Some of the great church fathers, great theologians in the history of the church, men like Tertullian, like Augustine, men like Origen, Clement of Alexandria, and so many others, came from North Africa. And after a few centuries, when North Africa cooled toward the gospel, the center of Christianity moved to Italy, to Rome. And God used Rome in many ways. And then in the days of the Reformation, the center of Christianity moved into Germany. And we can certainly see how God has used Germany in his plan. Not only to bring us the Anglo-Saxon common law, but to bring us the principles of the Reformation and the great music of Bach and so many others. And also used Germany in some very terrible ways too, with the Third Reich and the Holocaust. But after a while, the center of Christianity moved westward. It moved to North America. And that's where it has been for a couple of centuries. But there's no guarantee it's going to stay there. Point is, yes, God has used America in a very special way in history. But he has used other nations. So what I am saying here is, yes, America is exceptional. But every nation is exceptional. But if every nation is exceptional, then no nation is really, really exceptional. So the real question that we should be asking here today is this. Is America exceptionally exceptional? And I'm going to answer that question yes. God has had a very, very special plan for America. He's used America in some very special ways. What makes America exceptionally exceptional? G.K. Chesterton, Roman Catholic and an Englishman, said that America is the only nation that was founded on a creed. I think he probably acknowledged that Israel was also founded on a creed. But you look to most nations, they're founded on a race, or an ethnic entity, or a geographical area. America was founded, he says, on a creed. Well, what is that creed? Alexis de Tocqueville, that French observer who traveled to America in the 1830s and wrote that classic work, Democracy in America, simply said that combining Christianity and freedom was the central creed of America. As he wrote, "The Americans combined the notions of Christianity and of liberty so intimately in their minds that it is impossible to make them conceive of the one without the other. And with them, this conviction does not spring from that barren, traditionary faith which seems to vegetate rather than live in the soul." Then he added, "In France, I have almost always seen the spirit of religion and the spirit of freedom marching in opposite directions. But in America, I found that they were intimately united and that they reign in common over the same country." One thing else Tocqueville noted about America, and that's that America is exceptional in that America has a clear record of its past, right from the very beginning. Hardly any other nation can have that record. You go to England, for example, and certainly we have clear records of what was going on in England up until back to the Norman conquest of 1066. And then we can look to the Anglo-Saxon period, and we have some records, the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle and others, of what was going on after the Angles and the Saxons conquered Britain and called it Angleland or England in the 400s. Before that, we have the Celtic period, but that's largely in the mists of legend. And what happened in those days, and what might have happened before that, we really don't know. The same can be said of Germany. The same can be said of China. Yes, we can go back to the Shang Dynasty and so on, but as to what was going on before that, and even what went on during the Shang Dynasty, there's a lot of uncertainty. But we have a clear record. We know from Columbus's journals, for example, that Columbus came, and we read exactly what he did. We read from his journals why he came. We read that he landed there on October 12th. And yes, I know I've probably said this before here, but my theory is that he treaded water there for 3 days before landing. The reason is he wanted to land on Columbus Day. Or we can go to the Jamestown settlement, and we know from history the first thing those Jamestown settlers did in 1607 is they planted a cross and they held a worship service. And we have clear records of what the colony did thereafter. But then we look especially to the Pilgrims. And there we have that wonderful work by William Bradford, The History of Plymouth Plantation. Bradford being the man who served as governor during many of those opening years and who was on the Mayflower. But he starts his History of Plymouth Plantation not just with the Mayflower coming into the Plymouth Harbor. He starts it way back in England with the Pilgrims as separatists in England. They weren't called Pilgrims in England because, well, they hadn't pilgrimed yet. And so they're called separatists or dissenters. And then he talks about their experience in the Netherlands after that, and then back to England, and from England to America on the Mayflower, the landing in Plymouth Harbor and so on, and things that happened year by year thereafter. Not only do we have his work, but Mort's Relation and other works as well that give us clear records of what was going on in that colony right from its beginnings way back in England. Or John Winthrop with the Massachusetts Bay Colony. And as he addresses those colonists as they are embarking, he says, "Thus stands the cause between God and us. We are entered into covenant with him for this work. We have taken out a commission. The Lord hath given us leave to draw our own articles." And I'm going to skip over some here, but "we shall find that the God of Israel is among us when 10 of us shall be able to resist 1,000 of our enemies, when he shall make us a praise and glory that men shall say of succeeding plantations, the Lord make it likely that of New England. For we must consider that we will be like a city on a hill. The eyes of all people are upon us, so that if we shall deal falsely with our God in this work that we have undertaken, and so cause him to withdraw his present help from us, we shall be made a story and a byword throughout the world. We shall open the mouths of enemies to speak evil of the ways of God and all professors for God's sake. We shall shame the faces of many of God's worthy servants and cause their prayers to be turned into curses upon us till we be consumed out of the good land whither we are a-going." Yes, they clearly believed in American exceptionalism, but it wasn't a right. It wasn't a privilege. It was a responsibility. It was a duty to God, and a duty that they could not violate except with the gravest consequences to themselves and to others. Yes, as we look to this colonial period, we see clearly their adherence to Christianity. In the early 1700s, they perhaps cool from this just a little bit, but then comes that great religious revival, the first Great Awakening in the 1740s, that maybe doesn't bring America exactly back to Puritanism, but at least brings America back to Jesus Christ. And then comes the American War for Independence, and the slogan during this war was, "No king, but King Jesus." And the Continental Congress had taken a particular hymn, or song, and made that the official song of the War for Independence. And it wasn't Yankee Doodle. It was Chester. And I'm going to do you a special favor and not sing it, but I'll give you the first verse. "Let tyrants wave their iron rods, and slavers clank their bloody chains. We fear them not, we trust in God. New England's God forever reigns." This was sung all the way from Georgia to New Hampshire. And notice in this time of crisis, they don't turn to Georgia's God. They don't turn to Jamestown's God, or Pennsylvania's God, or Maryland's God. New England's God, the God of the Pilgrims and the Puritans, forever reigns. And then comes our Declaration of Independence. And that's another factor that makes America exceptional. A clear statement as to our reasons for independence, a clear statement of a philosophy of government, one that has served as a model for many other nations across the world. We're going to be hearing a lot about the Declaration of Independence this coming year. We'll be hearing things, for example, that one that we'll hear is that, well, the Declaration, it really was a reactionary document by the landed aristocracy. And they didn't really mean what they said. Yes, they said all men are created equal, but they didn't really believe that. They were slaveholders. Well, yes, it is true. Some of them were slaveholders. In fact, somewhere between 11 and 17 of those 56 signers of the Declaration were slaveholders. But if 11 to 17 were slaveholders, well, do the math. That means between 39 and 45 were not slaveholders. and many of those strongly oppose slavery. Some of them belong to abolition societies. But we look to that Declaration of Independence, and we're going to see many other things that are going to be distorted. One is the idea, as I said, that it's a hypocritical and reactionary document. The other is that it is a revolutionary document out of the age of reason, out of the Enlightenment. And Jefferson and the other authors' goal in the Declaration was to throw off not only monarchy, but organized religion and all things that suppress people, and create a new order for the ages of secular man. Well, first of all, that sounds like a contradiction to the first argument. But secondly, they do have this in common. Both of them are utterly ignoring and thereby denying the actual language of the Declaration itself. The Declaration begins by saying that we are entitled to our independence by the laws of nature and of nature's God. It goes on to say that we hold these self-evident truths, that all men are created, not evolved equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights. Creation is the only firm basis for believing in equality, and rights being endowed by the Creator is the only firm basis for believing in human rights. If you believe rights come from the government, government can take them away. And so they're not really unalienable rights. They are negotiable privileges. And then we close with appealing to the supreme judge of the world for the rectitude of our intentions. In other words, a clear recognition that this will not succeed unless we are in accordance with the higher law of God. And finally, with a firm reliance upon divine providence. Clearly, they recognize that without God's aid, as Franklin said at the Constitutional Convention, we shall succeed in this political building no better than the builders of Babel. When the Declaration was signed, Sam Adams, a man who many call the father of the American Revolution, simply said, it really amounts to this. We have this day restored the sovereign to whom all men ought to be obedient. He reigns in heaven, and from the rising to the setting sun, may his kingdom come. His cousin John Adams, well, he thought that really we ought to be celebrating Independence Day on July 2nd, not July 4th. But that's because Congress voted for independence on July 2nd. They actually approved the Declaration on July 4th, but John Adams said, the second day of July 1776 will be the most memorable epoch in the history of America. I am apt to believe that it will be celebrated by succeeding generations as the great anniversary festival. It ought to be commemorated as the day of deliverance by solemn acts of devotion to God Almighty. It ought to be solemnized with pomp and parade, with shows, games, sports, guns, bells, bonfires, and illuminations from one end of this continent to the other, from this time forward, forevermore. The Declaration of Independence is really a philosophy of government, and it makes America exceptional. Our Constitution is another thing that makes America exceptional. A Constitution that is based on two fundamental principles. One, a high view of God and his law. Two, a low view of man and his nature. The framers recognize that we are sinners and therefore we need government. We can't live in anarchy. But they also knew that those that run the government have the same sinful nature as everybody else, and therefore they can't be trusted with absolute power. And so they devised a system giving government enough power to govern effectively, but restraining that power with checks and balances and the like, so it would not become tyrannical and oppressive. And that Constitution has served as a model for constitutions all across the world. Free enterprise is another thing that has made America exceptional. The free enterprise system that is based upon property rights, contract rights, based upon a work ethic. The best economic system will not work if people don't have a work ethic, and Protestantism supplied that work ethic. That is one thing that produced the prosperity that made America the strong nation it became. Think of the things America has done. Here's one thing. Humanitarian aid. What nation anywhere in the history of the world has done more to engage in humanitarian aid in times of disaster, whether it's man-made disaster or natural disaster? What nation has done more on that than the United States? And our free enterprise system is one thing that has enabled us to do that. Another is the American military. And it takes money to have a strong military. And America's military has been a force for good in the world. God used the American military to defeat Nazism, to defeat communism, and now to hold back radical Islam. What about missions? America gives more to missions than any other nation in the earth. Bibles. More Bibles have been printed in America than any other nation in history. In fact, the Gideons alone in the 1900s printed more than 1 billion, not million, 1 billion, 1,000 million Bibles. In America, 92% of people own a Bible. A few of them even read it. Is America always going to remain this exceptional nation? There is no guarantee of that. It seems like independence, liberty, is something that we're willing to sacrifice. If we can have security, stability, we're willing to sacrifice liberty just so that we can be sure that we're going to be fed and we're going to be clothed and given what we need. The desire for liberty, whether it's national independence or personal independence, seems to be eroding today. We've talked about Christianity that has made this nation what it is. Yes, most Americans still claim to be Christians, although that term seems to be defined more and more broadly. We still send missionaries all over the world, though in some churches they're really more like social workers. But why should we be sending missionaries to reclaim Christ, if we believe all religions are equal, if we don't believe that Jesus Christ is the only way that God has provided for our salvation, why bother sending missionaries? If we believe the Bible is full of errors and is merely human wisdom, why should we be printing Bibles and circulating them throughout the world? Yes, we're seeing a lot of things changing in America today. Hatred of America is true in many parts of the world, but probably less true in most parts of the world than in parts of America itself. Look, for example, what's going on in California. You see people waving the Mexican flag, the flag of a country they don't want to go back to, and burning the flag of the country that they want to stay in. Yes, I know they'll say, oh, we want to make California Mexico again. Yes, if they do, they'll make it like Mexico again. There still is much, much good about America. And the question I would ask here is, where would we go if America falls? It always used to be that nations across the world, as they struggle for liberty, if our struggles fail, there's always that land across the ocean that we can flee to. If America falls, where can we go? Some of you may have heard of Richard Wurmbrand, a Lutheran pastor who spent 14 years in communist prisons. I read his works way back when I was in law school, little knowing that one day I'd be able to count him as a friend and he would be a guest in my home. But Wilbur Brand wrote, every freedom-loving man has two fatherlands, his own and America. Today, America is the hope of every enslaved man because it is the last bastion of freedom in the world. Only America has the power and spiritual resources to stand as a barrier between militant communism and the peoples of the world. America is the last dike holding back the rampaging floodwaters of militant communism. If it crumbles, there is no other dike, no other dam, no other line of defense to fall back upon. America is the last hope of millions of enslaved peoples. They look to it as their second fatherland. In it lies their hopes and prayers. I have seen fellow prisoners in communist prisons beaten, tortured, with 50 pounds of chains on their legs, praying for America, that the dike will not crumble, that it will remain free. Do we pray for America as they did? We certainly should. Because freedom is a fragile thing. If we lose it here, where will we find it? Yes, America is truly an exceptional nation. And in the broad sense, America is a Christian nation. And I am very, very glad for both.